And by the way, one note about on and off the record. So usually, if there's our rule at quorumreport.com has been since about 1986, before we were online, if there was alcohol present, it's off the record. And okay. My boss.
We'll cut all this out. Don't worry about it.
Well, my boss. Well, I'll tell you, I'm making an exception for the show. We're just journalists here, so it doesn't count.
Hey guys, welcome back to Yolitics here. We're back at one of our favorite places. We haven't been here in a minute. Last time we were here, we had a state senator.
We did.
Who was cussing
Carlin Gutierrez.
Okay, well, there you go. Cussing up a storm on the podcast.
Yes. And, our little bleeper button got to work out that day.
Yeah, so we're happy to be back at Petacolis Brewing Company. Is this the design district? I guess it is a little bit the design district.
Yeah, design district in Dallas, north. Near downtown Dallas.
And yeah.
There is a kid in the house here somewhere. I think they're playing ping pong or something upstairs.
Do we need to control our language? Is that it?
Yeah.
She's a really good ping pong player, I can tell you that.
And she's very excited about it. So you may hear her a couple of times during this podcast. There she goes.
And there she is, exactly. And you've already heard our guest today, the great Scott Braddock, editor of the Quorum Report. He is with us today. Live and in person.
Yeah,
on Yolitics.
Nice.
Usually you're hounding the pavement in Austin, but
we're all over the state. That 2017 Tacoma outside has 190,000 miles
wide. Does it really?
As I travel this entire, as I call it, the great state. You can't really get to know her if you don't go see her. So I'm always on the road.
How's that Tacoma holding up?
You know what?
It's
Toyota. Like the day that I'll tell you a quick story. It's like the day I bought it. Of course, you'd have to do a few things to it. Nothing that was more than about a $1,500 problem.
Not
over,
bad.
Over the decade that I've had it. You know, they had a truck that Toyota sold to some guy. He put 1,000,000 miles on it.
Wow.
A few years back. He posted it to social media that it rolled over 1,000,000 miles. Toyota reached out and they wanted to get it from him because they wanted to autopsy that truck.
Sure.
How I was able to do that. And so they said, we'll give you any truck that you want if you'll give us that one. And so that's how they worked out. Maybe I can get that deal with this one.
Yeah, just keep going.
I'll just keep driving.
That probably rolled off an assembly line in San Antonio,
right?
This one would not have been from San Antonio. This is the Tacoma, and what they're building down there is the Big Tundra. That's the one I'll get from them when I get to 1,000,000 miles.
Deep in Texas knowledge right here. Yeah. Come on. He knows the assembly line work as well. What do you have?
What are you drinking?
I am having, and this feels right today, the Melee in the USA.
Okay.
Yeah, it kind of fits because we're talking about elections and politics here. This is actually one of their World Cup beers that they've turned out. They also have the TKO in Mexico.
Oh, cool.
Because we've got a bunch of World Cup games coming here to North Texas. I really wanted the Hive Dive,
which is honey ale.
Yeah.
I'm disappointed you didn't get it.
Was that a little too strong for you, the other one? Or
this one just felt like it was right, name-wise.
It's the right name, yeah.
Well, it's good.
Scott, our avid listeners will know that he likes fruity beers, as fruity as possible.
Oh, and if it has a cherry in it, you like it, right?
You know what I love is
cherry.
I've seen the show.
You know what I love is
a good mead.
Yeah?
Okay. Good mead.
It's hard to find meads.
The last time I saw y'all in person, you went straight for a mead. That's what I remember.
Did they have the meads over there?
It's hard to find.
It's a medieval order,
It is. People are like, well, this is now in the 2000s, and so we don't have
that. We're not pouring syrup here today. I'm having the Golden Opportunity, one of their famous Kolsch beer that I always get here.
Yeah, our avid listeners also know that Jason Whiteley is a very old man who always does the exact same thing.
All right, Boomer. Wow. All right, Boomer.
I wasn't at the bar when y'all were ordering. I didn't know you had the same. This is the Golden Opportunity,
See?
And I ordered
that,
it.
Huh?
Cheers.
I ordered it
because it's a Golden Opportunity to talk to y'all.
Oh, like well played. Well
here.
Played. Hey, yeah. So you're up here in North Texas. You're all over the state, but you're in North Texas after that huge win by Ken Paxton last night in Plano. He's now the Republican nominee for U.S. Senate, defeating John Cornyn. This was a landslide.
Huge.
I didn't think the margin would be anywhere near that. He won two-thirds of the vote.
Yeah, and I think you and I were talking about it. It didn't surprise you that he won, but the margin is what surprised
you.
Yeah, and I was not as surprised, and here's the reason. In traveling the state so much, in the last two election cycles, y'all know that President Trump really got involved at the legislative level. Y'all saw where he was taking out those state senators in Indiana, and I was reminding some of the national folks and national media calling me the last few days about that Trump endorsement. I said, he was doing that in Texas way before Indiana. He was helping the governor go after Texas House members who didn't agree with the governor about school vouchers.
So
if I go back to my reporter's notebook, and I look at the conversations I had with Republican voters all over the state, in East Texas, West Texas, you know, down in the valley, everywhere, they would say two things. One, they would say that, yeah, if they were undecided, the presidents could, you know, the president could help them, you know, figure it out, which I'm not surprised by that. Here's what was really surprising. In so many conversations, Republican voters told me that they might have been planning to vote for one candidate, and then the president endorsed the other, and they switched their vote. They switched to the other person. No other endorsement could do that. Governor Abbott, not the little governor Dan Patrick, you know, Ken Paxton himself, none of those guys could get anybody to switch their plan for who they were going to vote for other than Trump. So I do think that over the course of the last week or so, even after, what, 200,000 votes or so were banked in that election by the time Trump made the endorsement, after that, I guarantee you there are some people who were going to vote for Cornyn who switched their vote to Paxton. Now, somebody, you know, somebody might hear that and think that that's not possible. But here's the other thing that's going on with that race. There was nobody to vote for who was what you might consider the old school Republican who's not MAGA at all.
Yeah.
And even though you might, John Cornyn moved. That's right. His entire campaign turned into, I'm with President Trump all the way. What did all of his commercials say?
Yep.
I vote with the president 99.some-odd% of the time, whatever it was, 99.7% of the time. And he could have gone further and said that when he was the Republican whip in the U.S. Senate during the first Trump administration, he wasn't just voting with Trump. He was getting all the other Republicans to vote for all his stuff, too, his agenda and his nominees and everything.
Trump said he was disloyal.
And then Trump said he was disloyal, which is just false, which is just a lie. But the president will say anything. So here's the reporting that we had at quorumreport.com, and it's not surprising, but a lot of times you pull the curtain back and you go, okay, that makes sense. It was my understanding, based on various conversations with Republican sources, that the way this played out was, y'all remember, it was about 2 weeks ago that the president was having the big throwdown with Senate Republicans about the money for his ballroom. And the leader of the Senate, John Thune, the Republican leader Thune, says, you know, we're not going to break every, this is the short version, we're not going to break every rule in the Senate to do that for you. Maybe if it was something else, we might bend this a little bit. But the president said, then fire the parliamentarian and just, you know, get some new rules. And, get you know, you fire, instead of firing the umpire after the game, which is what you do in baseball, he wanted them to fire the umpire in the middle of the game. And Thune said he wouldn't do that. So it was around that same time. That's my understanding. Stephen Miller, or whoever it is that Trump listens to in the White House, put a poll on his desk from Texas that said, Ken Paxton's going to win this thing running away, and if you endorse him now, then to the rest of the world, it will look like you have your momentum, and you just beat Massey in Kentucky, you beat Cassidy in Louisiana, and now you can say that you beat Cornyn in Texas. And nothing matters more to the president, y'all know this in reporting on him, than being right, being in charge, and consolidating power. That's what it allows him to do within the Republican Party. But the flip side of that is he's losing the U.S. Senate before the Republicans even have a chance to, because they're not going to vote for his stuff now. A lot of people would say, hey, you know what? Maybe they don't have a lot left to do this year. Maybe they won't even be in session in Washington that much. But think of it this way. Any other president who was similarly situated right now, you know, staring down the barrel of the opposition party will probably take the U.S. House next year, potential that they also take the Senate, you would want to do as much as you could now. You might roll out a legislative agenda to cement your legacy for the rest of this year, and then work with the leadership in your own party, with the Speaker and with the U.S. House Republican leader, get them to go along with what you want to do now. Because for the last 2 years of the presidency, it'll be nonstop investigations of Trump, and you know, they'll be impeaching him again and all of that. Someone who was taking, I'll just say it, someone who was taking the job seriously and thinking that way about what their legacy for the United States is going to be, would be doing that. Instead, Trump's alienating the members of his own party in Washington.
Well, but those Republican senators aren't looking at what happened to Cassidy and what happened to Cornyn and going, okay, we better get in line here. Are they doing that? Or are they going, you know what, now I've got a bad taste in my mouth and now I'm going to drag my feet a little bit?
A couple of things, and it's the right question. You know, the House, and I love when I'm talking about this in Austin, it's very similar. The House of Representatives, it's loud. It's, you know, these almost screaming debates at each other. And the thing about the House is it's mostly just about math. Do you have the votes? Mm-hmm. And in Washington, similar, the Republicans have a slim majority in the House, and so they couldn't afford to lose any Republicans on any votes. But it's math. It's easy to figure out. The Senate's not as easy. The Senate is more about relationships. Think about it like a club that only has 100 members.
Yeah.
And they do club up, and they think of their colleagues as their friends. John Cornyn is somebody who isn't just their buddy. He also raised millions and millions of dollars for them to win their own elections.
And he was there for a very long time.
Oh, yeah. And now, coming up for the next 2 years, the vast majority of these senators will be thinking this way. They'll think, look, no matter what happens now, politically, I'm going to outlive the president after the next 2 years, and then he's gone. And so they can kind of do whatever they want. And so you may have folks like Cassidy, and you may have folks like Tom Tillis. I heard somebody call them the YOLO caucus the other day. They're just doing whatever they're going to do now. And those will be the outspoken people. With Cornyn, look, I've known him a long time, 25 years or whatever. He's somebody who is still a judge at heart. You know, he started his career as a state district court judge in Bexar County down in San Antonio.
Yeah.
Moved on to be the Supreme Court Justice in Texas. And then he was, of course, the Attorney General here. He's got that mindset, a judicial temperament. I don't imagine Cornyn throwing a lot of bombs at the president. I don't think that's going to happen, not to say that he won't. Because who can predict anything anymore? But that's not my expectation. What I would expect is that he takes his role as a senator seriously, and instead of throwing bombs, instead he just doesn't vote for Trump's stuff. And if you don't vote for Trump's stuff, that also gives cover to the other Republicans to not vote for his stuff either.
And you think that's going to happen?
Because if you lose two or three of those Republican senators, it means that whatever the thing is that is in question just doesn't get voted on, which means they never have to go on the record about it. And then it's harder to know in the Senate who it is that's really your problem, right? Unless you go really talk to them and say, "Are you with me on my thing?" And really, the power of a senator, if you think about it, senators are at their most powerful when they don't do anything.
So he could be a quiet problem for
Absolutely.
President Trump going forward.
When a senator is often at their most powerful is when they don't do anything and they make the person who wants something come talk to them and convince them to vote for their thing. Otherwise, they just don't move forward with their agenda.
So the Cook Political Report has now, a day or so ago, moved this race between Tallarico and Ken Paxton from likely Republican to lean Republican, which makes sense in this state.
Sure.
But are there enough MAGA voters in this state to elect Paxton as the next U.S. Senator?
Little Governor Patrick gave a speech at the Texas Public Policy Foundation the other day in which he started out by trashing me. And then the next thing he did was he talked about, he said nobody reads the Quorum Report except him and everybody else in Austin.
Yeah, exactly.
But
we read it.
But
yeah.
Thank you. But the thing that he talked about that made all the headlines was this plea that he was making to Republicans that they've got to get in line this fall. That if 15, as he said, if 15% of the Cornyn supporters or 15% of the Paxton supporters don't show up and vote for whoever the Republican nominee is, then James Tallarico is going to be the senator.
And some polling has found that they are saying that some of these voters are saying, I'm Paxton only or I'm Cornyn only and I will not cross over. Is that really going to happen?
Yeah, that's what I'm not sure about. Most of my career in covering politics in Texas has been to observe and write about and talk about Republican on Republican political violence in these primaries. They always rip each other to shreds, right? Mm-hmm. But we've never seen this well a financed or high profile example of that. And everybody noticed. Those of us who follow this all the time and the people who watch and listen to your show know about it. But to the broader public, they noticed it. They saw it on full display, these Republicans just eviscerating each other. And it's gross to people. It's gross. They see all these ads talking about, Paxton's divorce, and they see all these ads about, Cornyn being a rhino and a liberal and all of this, and it's gross to people. One observation that you can make about what happens when these campaigns get so nasty is you might think that it would get more people involved because they kind of want to fix that, right? But instead, it has the opposite effect. It alienates people, and a lot of folks will say, I don't want anything to do with this. And so it does present an opportunity for Democrats. Think about this. In Texas, over the last 20, 25 years, really three decades since Republicans have really cemented power here, they've been able to build up structural advantages that lead them to about a 10-point structural advantage in a general election.
Jeez. Yeah.
About 10 points. That's kind of where they start. But because of all the baggage he brings to the table, and think of this, here in DFW, Paxton and his soon-to-be ex-wife are going to have their divorce proceedings starting next month, and nobody goes to trial on a divorce unless it's really ugly, right? And so there'll be some headlines out of that have been beneficial to Democrats. if you think about all of that baggage, and this is common, sort of common wisdom, you know, the common knowledge or wisdom among Republican operatives who are not affiliated with these campaigns right now, is that Paxton's candidacy cuts that 10-point advantage into about a 5-point advantage for Republicans. Mm. So that gives Tallarico a boost.
Because of his baggage?
Yeah, and he, you know, and Paxton, you know, he'll have whatever money he needs. He's the Republican nominee in Texas. But here comes Tallarico with not just a fortune already in the bank, but also at this point in the election cycle, he's polling, his public polling, it's polling better than Beto O'Rourke was at this same point in the cycle when he ended up coming 3 points away from beating Cruz. Mm-hmm. And think about the headwinds that Republicans face in general. Last night, I was at the Paxton event here in DFW, as you mentioned, and some of the Republicans who were there were saying, well, no. Paxton's baggage, that's not going to matter. That's not what's dragging down you know, the Republicans. But then that same, one of the same people said, it's Trump. Trump is what's dragging us down. It's the national environment. Look at the polling on everything that people care about. Energy prices, the price of gas, the price of everything, the war in Iran, all of this, everything people actually care about. Republicans aren't just underwater. In some cases, it's 70-30 against Republicans. And so that has a Republicans really freaked out about their down ballot races. So the history of the minority party winning a race in this state isn't at the top of the ticket. Mm-hmm. It's some of the down ballot races, right? Mm-hmm. It's when Rick Perry beat Jim Hightower many years ago to be one of the first Republicans elected statewide. And when you have a top of the ticket that's weak, that means the other Republicans have to pick up the slack. So think about how much money they can bring to the table. You got Greg Abbott with he'll have $150 million, something like that, to spend the cycle. The lieutenant governor will have something like $40 to $50 million, something like that. Allied organizations like Texans for Lawsuit Reform can put in another $40 to $50 million. You're talking about $250 million that will be spent on behalf of the Republican ticket to prop all of this up. So that's what Tallarico is up against.
That's extreme.
Yeah, that's an insane amount of money. Here's a question we talked about in our coverage last night on WFAA. Mm-hmm. The first ad that Paxton put out.
Yeah.
A few days ago against Tallarico was
a
loaded.
Punch in the face.
What did you think of that?
He nailed. I mean, everyone,
just hitting him.
He's hitting him hard. He's hitting him very hard, and that's only ad one. Mm-hmm. That's only ad one.
He had one out today that I thought had better production value, but it's the same stuff.
But it's and
Tallarico's left wing. He's too liberal. All of that.
He doesn't like meat. You know, whatever.
Tacos. Yeah.
But you know, at the end of the day, here we watch what happened with Beto O'Rourke. Democrats get so excited with him. Beto didn't hit back in 2018 until the last 2 weeks.
Right.
Is when he showed his teeth.
Mm-hmm.
Tallarico's this nice looking guy, seminarian. Mm-hmm. You know, never raises his voice. Mm. Is he and his campaign going to hit back at Paxton early? Or are they going to try to take the high road like Democrats have done in the past?
They're going to. Well, I think that what you're going to see is a blend of the two. If they do it in a way that, has worked before for another high-profile Democrat, they would take the Obama model, which was, remember, Obama's nickname in the campaigns was No Drama Obama. Same guy who would, you know, never raise his voice, never get too worked up about anything. He's always trying to, you know, be slow and steady wins the race. But he had allies and organizations that were doing the attacking, doing the attack dog stuff. So you're going to see these various PACs that are Democratic organizations that will spend millions of dollars, and they'll have a lot of material to work with Paxton.
Exactly.
To blow him up as being
pretty big binders.
He's a liar. He's corrupt. He's an adulterer
Scott. None of that stuck. Cornyn spent $90 million, and none of that stuck with MAGA voters. Is that going to stick with these independents in Texas that always
think
that
is? It didn't stick.
I don't know. You tell me.
Ever since the Monica Lewinsky scandal in the 90s.
Which outraged Republicans, completely outraged them.
Yep.
The Ralph Reeds.
Ever since then.
Sure.
The American electorate has been told a version of this. That all politicians are lying, corrupt cheaters. Right? And Republicans and Democrats have been tarred with this. Of course, it's not true. But that doesn't matter. That's what they were told. And if they're told all the time that everybody's a lying, corrupt cheater, what is the eventual consequence of that? It's that it levels the playing field for lying, corrupt cheaters.
Yeah.
Right? Because all across the state, as I talk to Republican voters, they would say, you know, yeah, he might have done that stuff. They would say this. I remember a meeting I spoke at in Aransas County, which is Trump country.
Sure.
I mean, I think in that last general,
the Coastal Bend,
they vote. The Coastal Bend loves Trump. It's I like the parts of Texas where, you know, you're on the beach and you see the red Trump flags in the sand, and and the thing. I mean, the numbers are overwhelming. In March and November, they would vote 80% for Trump and Paxton, yeah. Right? And they would say, yeah, he probably did all that stuff. That doesn't matter. He does what I want him to do in office.
Right.
And
he
delivers. He's a fighter. We hear that a lot.
So if you start with your baseline understanding being that everybody's a corrupt, lying cheater, then all you care about is, do they do the things that I agree with? And increasingly within the GOP, you know, it's just agreement with Trump. Do you agree with what the president is doing? And Paxton is the one who they see as doing that.
Well, that's a harder hill to climb for Tallarico then. If this stuff doesn't stick, if what Cornyn was, you know, showcasing doesn't stick to these voters, it's a harder hill to climb for Tallarico to convince them that it does.
I think that the Republican who decided to not vote in this runoff, someone who would see themselves as an old school Republican or a mainstream Republican, that's the way they used to think of themselves, could eventually be open to voting for a Democrat. But here's what's interesting in the numbers. As I've covered this stuff over the years, we've always kind of understood the electorate in Texas to be made up of about a third, and a third, Republicans, Democrats, and Independents. Mm. But all across the country, including here in Texas, that third bucket of the Independents is growing. People self-identify as Independent. They think that, you know, both parties suck. They're not representing me. There's nowhere for me in either of these parties. And if you look at the Independent numbers and all of that polling, they're more and more disgusted with the president. Now, I'm not calling the president the leader of a cult. But others have said that, right? So let's play that out. If you look at the polling on this, how do people view cult leaders? If you're in the cult, you think they can do no wrong. They're almost like a deity on earth, and I'm just going to follow that guy no matter what, including switching my vote if he endorses the person against the person that I liked before. But if you're not in the cult, you despise that person. You despise whoever that is, the people who have been. And so, point being, if you look at the polling for the president and the it is fully his Republican Party, especially here in Texas now, on all the issues people care about, they're disgusted with it. And we don't even know how frustrated Americans will be with what's becoming a protracted war in the Middle East that we're involved in. And isn't it, I mean, it's worth saying that it's remarkable to me how casually the United States is at war. Mm-hmm. We're just kind of casually, like, it's not even something that comes up in everyday conversation, yep. Whereas when we were before, y'all remember as recently as, you know, the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, that was on people's minds all the time.
Yeah, headlines and
first, story, yeah.
And by the way, this will sound, you know, I don't know, it's certainly not pandering. My mother was born at Kelly Air Force Base in San Antonio. We're a military family, I just think about the fact that those people who are serving, it's such... as a percentage, is such a small group who are making those sacrifices, yeah. It's easier than ever for people to be kind of completely removed from it.
Yeah.
I was, earlier today, I got a tour of this was cool, I got a tour of the Medal of Honor Museum over in Arlington.
Oh, yeah.
And that's
sure.
Where I was right before this, and the sacrifices those people made, great Texans like Roy Benavides Jr., and who is from where I'm from in Southeast Texas in Wharton County. You have just the ability of people to kind of be on autopilot about that. But as that affects energy prices, as that affects everyday life in the United States, and as that drags on, look, unless gas goes back to $2 a gallon, I don't think that the prospects for Republicans are going to get any better.
Yeah, right. That's an interesting point. This war hasn't been getting talked about a lot, but when it starts to affect your daily life, it doesn't matter if you're thinking specifically about the war. You're thinking
right.
about those gas prices. You're thinking about the grocery prices. You're thinking about, I mean, people are planning summer travel,
yeah.
And they're looking at these airfares and going, where'd this come from?
Yeah, right.
And it's all you can trace it back.
Yeah.
Let's switch off. Well, actually, before we talk about Democrats here and the big headlines,
I might need another beer
night.
If you're going to talk about Democrats.
The bottom line was on Tuesday night, big night for MAGA candidates. Mays Middleton ended up winning. Bo French narrowly won the Railroad Commission
seat. I saw him at the Paxton deal last night.
Was he over there?
Oh, yeah. He was. He was not the most famous person there, but he was among them.
Here's the thing, and we all have been around Texas long enough to see this actually happen. The Republican Party of Texas has now made the full transformation from the Reagan-Bush era to MAGA. After the defeat of John Cornyn was the last man standing.
Oh, yeah.
And even though he tried to present, you know, say that he was a MAGA guy,
yeah.
we have now seen that happen.
And it's made its way all the way down the ballot. Else. I mean, even to the Absolutely. Railroad Commission race with this candidate.
Oh, yeah, a lot of our legislators as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It surprised you about that, though, that it wasn't just Paxton that won, but these other guys, with the exception of Beau French, everyone else won with pretty wide margins here.
I think the struggle within the Republican Party, it's been mismatched for a while over the last generation. Some of those old school, you know, Reaganite, Bush Republicans.
Sure.
I mean, I don't know if it's controversial or not, but a lot of the people who now sort of worship at the altar of Ronald Reagan would probably actually have hated him when he was president. I mean, he signed the amnesty, you know, for undocumented people, but they would have railed against that.
It's a different world.
He came from California.
Yeah.
But if you think about that transition and what's happened over the years, there was a time when the Reaganite and the Bushies, they were in party building mode, and they were constantly recruiting candidates, and they were constantly trying to build the Republican Party in the United States, and specifically here in Texas. George H.W. Bush, his district in Congress, was in what we now consider to be the cradle of the establishment Republican Party in the U.S., which is West Houston area, right? And at that time, they were always working on who the next generation of Republicans would be. And at some point, they ceded that ground to the Tea Party folks, the MAGA folks, who would always be in recruitment mode. You would see they'd have these Patriot Academies, or they bring in, you know, young people all the way down to adolescents and college kids to be the next, you know, version of Republicans. That used to be those college Republicans that Karl Rove would have been involved when he was a young man. And increasingly, the ones who are, you know, sort of preparing the next generation within the Republican Party have been those people. And that work has now come. I was thinking about this at the Paxton deal last night, at the bar with these folks. They're celebrating their victory, and I'm thinking this is the ascent of those folks. I mean, they're seeing it all.
They waited decades.
They've been working decades.
Yeah, they were at it.
And those Bush Republicans, the John Cornyns, didn't do that. I mean, who would John Cornyn's preferred successor have been? You know, the reporting had been it was somebody like Dan Crenshaw in Houston, who also lost his primary.
Lost as well, yeah.
One of these more mainstream, quote-unquote mainstream Republicans. And, you know, we constantly have to kind of reevaluate the way we talk about these different groups.
Yeah. I mean,
is what we're saying accurate? Is what we're saying, you know, really really giving people the right, you know, idea about what's going on here? And here's the deal. Paxton is now the mainstream Republican.
Is that, yeah.
Right. I mean, think about it.
Let's say
Beau
that again.
French is now
exactly.
the mainstream Republican. And
exactly.
look at the ticket. It's French, it's Middleton, it is Paxton, it's Dan Patrick, it's Greg Abbott. The two people who have kind of defied political gravity about this are the governor and the little governor, because they have moved further and further toward that MAGA wing and have been, you know, they're right there with Trump, you know, not just, you know, in spirit, but physically have been with Trump, you know, on the border in Washington and going right along with the MAGA agenda. They've been able to kind of paint themselves still to primary voters still as outsiders, even though they've been in office for more than a decade.
Okay, so this has been a decades-long project by the far right here in Texas. They've finally gotten what they want. They've got the full ticket, and it's all them. Is there a chance that they become the dog that finally caught the car and then doesn't know what to do with it? In other words, do Democrats have any chance of finally getting back in this arena and pulling off a statewide victory for the first time since 1994? That is a long drought.
It's a long time to be in the wilderness, and there's a long history in Texas of Democrats getting excited about races they can't win.
A long history, my friend.
I always think about you know, all of the young Democrats out there, and for them, the most inspiring race that they've ever witnessed, the most inspiring campaign, was one that they still lost to Ted Cruz in 2018.
Yeah,
it's interesting to watch, you know, some people now coming in to politics who don't even have memory of that. They're brand new voters who weren't even around for, you know, Cruz versus O'Rourke, and they just don't know any better. They don't know what you said, that the Democrats just don't win around here. For the people who have been observing Texas politics longer than myself, like my publisher, Mr. Kronberg, for example, who's 75 years old and was covering Texas when it was a true swing state, when a Republican or Democrat could win statewide. He has memory of that. He can envision it because he's seen it. you know, some guys like us, we haven't really seen that in our lifetime, so it's harder to imagine. And then, but then you also have those youngsters who haven't seen it, but their imagination, they haven't been broken by by going through so many of these campaigns. You know, they haven't learned any, you know, any different that they can't win these things, and so they'll try their best. But I mean, look, as far as getting an organization together, putting something together that can be durable and win, they're going to have to be steady. They're going to have incredible fundraising because of the numbers we laid out before. Because look, Tallarico has the challenge. Everybody knows who Paxton is. He just had $100 million spent against him. It's a well-defined person. And they're about to start defining Tallarico with those ads you were talking about. And, you know, he I saw his campaign this morning already blasting Paxton. Cornyn's kind of done that for you. You know, what they might want to focus on is really reintroducing and introducing for the first time Tallarico to people who still have not heard of him.
Yeah.
And their first ad was meet Ken Paxton,
right?
As opposed to meet James Tallarico, which is interesting.
Right.
I want to ask you about a couple of congressional races.
Yeah.
Let's start in Dallas. Democratic side, Colin Allred, Julie Johnson. Mm-hmm. This was a seat that was a victim of the redistricting that Texas did last year. So they took District 33, which used to stretch from Tarrant County to Dallas County. Mark Vesey's the incumbent now, and they shoved that straight into Dallas County and turned Julie Johnson's seat, current seat, District 32, into a big Republican seat that stretches from East Dallas all the way over to the Louisiana border.
Like you do.
Yeah, right.
That's how you do it. That's how you can do it in redistricting, son.
They have exactly. They have a lot in common there between Far East Texas. But Colin Allred, who ran twice for Senate unsuccessfully, spent millions of dollars, was able to knock off Julie Johnson here. What do you make of that?
You know, I was not surprised by it for a few reasons. One, what happens in redistricting very often when two incumbents or two, one former member and one incumbent, when they get paired in the same area, it turns into Hunger Games. And so they'll fight each other. And sometimes it's a Republican and a Democrat, and sometimes it's two Democrats or two Republicans. That district, as I was looking at the map when it was first drawn, I saw that it was drawn most demographic-wise, it was drawn more for a black or brown person, right? So more of a coalition-type district. In the first round of voting, I took note of the fact that in the Oak Lawn area, which is a part of that, that Allred won that area when Johnson was kind of counting on a lot of that LGBTQ vote, which would make sense.
It's a big LGBTQ area.
Absolutely. Yeah. She's kind of counting on that. One of my observations about Representative Johnson, and I like her a lot, and we have always had a good working relationship, but in her campaigns, I think, has had, and I could point to specific examples, of having sort of an entitlement mentality. Mm-hmm. What I mean is, and I believe it was an interview with you, where you asked her about which seat she might end up running for as they were figuring these maps out, and at that time, I think the court challenge might have been getting underway, and they were trying to figure that out. And she told y'all, on the record, that she and VC were having conversations about who was going to run for what and that they would figure that out. Mm-hmm. And I'm shaking my head thinking, that's not what you say on television. You know, you say, we'll figure this out. You don't say on TV that you're cutting a deal with another congressman to figure out what you're going to do.
Yeah.
And that takes me to the next point, which is that when you have a sense, and there were other examples of this, but when you have a sort of a sense of entitlement, it's not just that it's a bad look. It's that when you have that sense, you don't fight for it as hard as you would if you didn't have a sense of entitlement, right? And so I never got the sense that her campaign was working as hard as they could to get that done. And then the other thing is for Allred, he came in with Senate money, right? He just came in with the Senate cash because he was running for Senate before that.
A lot of name ID for 2 years.
Switched over from that, and he's able to wallet whip it in a way that she was not able to.
Another big race we were watching that you might have a lot more insight on is the congressional race in Houston, the Republican race between Briscoe Kane and Alex Mealer. Yeah. Alex Mealer just destroyed Briscoe Kane, which I didn't have a good feel for that race, but I was surprised again at the margin. She had a tremendous amount of money.
Yeah. And
she just flooded name ID? Is that what it was or what?
So the Crypto Bros and Anthropic through their PACs really invested heavily in some races in Texas. And that race in Houston's one of them. One of the races down in the San Antonio area was one of them. You might want to ask about that one. I think the spending in that was something like approaching $8 million on her behalf.
Yeah.
Wow.
To maybe around $1 million for Kane. Something like that.
I think he had less than that.
It might have been more like $700,000.
Yeah, I think that's what it was.
So you know, Kane is somebody who's been a good candidate over the years. He's been through some tough races for sure, especially his first primary. But when you face that onslaught of especially in a newly drawn, you know, in a newly drawn district.
Sure.
And both these candidates having to introduce themselves to a lot of new voters. Now, both of them had some electoral history, of course, one a state representative and one who ran for Harris County judge unsuccessfully, but I think ran pretty well in that part of the county. When you have that kind of money advantage, not much you can do. But also in Houston, if anybody in Houston's watching or listening later, she had the Mattress Mac Mafia with her. You know, Mac, as you know, a legendary business guy. And he was. And it was my understanding that when Kane started the race, when he announced for that seat, Mattress Mac, his Republican allies in the area, had already made a lot of the calls on behalf of Mueller, and that as Kane started trying to call around for endorsements and money, the kind of calls that you make, the answer he would get back from various players in Houston, well, you know, Mac already told me I'm with Mueller.
Wow.
And that's how those calls would start and end.
Wow, already got
so,
locked up.
And so that was already kind of locked up. And you know, just as a point of fact, she was also that with that group, with Mattress Mac and Michael Berry and some of those influential folks in Houston. She was also their candidate for Harris County judge. So
sure.
That was part of the campaign infrastructure she had in place. So it didn't surprise me.
Christian Menefee also, District 18 down there in the Houston area, just walked away with it against longtime Congressman Al Green.
Yeah, that's one where the margin did surprise me. I mean, it was overwhelming, right? And you know, in the first round of voting in that, the part of the district that gets down into Fort Bend County had showed up heavy for Al Green, but he was facing a challenge that was insurmountable. You know, in Houston, they have sort of PTSD, and I mean in a serious way. They had sort of a PTSD thing going on with the fact that they just, in the last few years, had two members of Congress die who represent the city, right? Sheila Jackson Lee.
That's a good point.
And then she was succeeded by Sylvester Turner, who didn't even serve in, I think, a month or two. Remember, he was at the State of the Union that year, and then the next day he had passed away, right?
Yeah.
There were pictures of him, sad and terrible. And so Green was put in the position of, as an older gentleman, having to assure people. And at some point he started to say, you know, it's ridiculous that I have to defend this idea that I'll be alive a couple of years from now. But that was really on people's minds. And he had, to some degree, I was talking to one of my friends in Houston, who really, you know, rolls up his sleeves and does all the work to understand African-American politics in the city, and said that it was a nifty trick that Green had done to take what can be the symbol of being old, which is that cane that he walks with, and he turned it into sort of an iconic thing holding that cane up and shaking it at President Trump.
You definitely see it at the State of the Union.
So he did his best, but it that was also one of those races where the crypto bros and all of them were really heavily investing in Menefee.
And
in
what
do
all these crypto bros and AI folks
what
are going to be expecting?
What is it that they
want?
Yeah, right. We'll figure that out. That's what you always figure out later after the election.
What could you imagine? So here we are, 5 months away from the general election. Things will slow down probably for a minute here as we go into the summer. People's minds go elsewhere. But when we get closer to Labor Day, everything will start kicking back up. Tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars like to be dumped in the state. What should we be watching for, Scott? What are you going to be watching for, man?
You know, I'll be interested to see what kind of legwork and what kind of organizational work these campaigns, especially at the top of the ticket, do over the next few months, trying to get things in place. As you say, it won't really kick into gear until later in the year. But
and we say legwork, like endorsements that Paxton might be reaching out to, Tallarico.
Endorsements and just a nonstop campaign. I mean, as you pointed out already, they're already starting their digital ad campaigns. Tallarico already has a rally scheduled for Austin this weekend, and I'm sure he's starting his tour against Ken Paxton.
Tonight in Houston, I think.
So I can't even remember what they were calling it, but it's basically, you know, the people power versus Ken Paxton, something like that. It sounds like good branding. They're going to have to do that. You know, it's not going to stop. The campaign is going to be nonstop. You're right. It'll ramp up at that time. A lot of the spending will ramp up at that time. Both of these candidates Paxton has run statewide before, obviously, but not for a position at this level. You know, not for the U.S. Senate. It's completely different. So when people say, I know what people mean in our industry when they'll say, well, you know, Paxton had all this baggage and he's run successfully statewide several times. He hasn't had the degree of scrutiny that has already been put on him by the Cornyn campaign with $100 million against him, really defining who he is. But the Democrats are about to do something similar, until we get to November, and we'll see if he can withstand that.
Hmm. I think it's going to be a crazy campaign. Does this get as nasty as what we saw between Cornyn and Paxton, though?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. it's all downhill from here. If you can imagine.
Just what we wanted, right?
If you can imagine it.
We're at the bottom of the hill, I thought.
Mean, it's every time you think it can't get any worse, boy, it does. Boy, howdy.
And I hate to push you past November already, because that's a lot to focus on as it is, but we've got a legislative session coming up at the start of next year. What are you thinking as we head into that? Do you have any early ideas on what that looks like? And what does the power structure look like going into that legislative session?
Well, to answer that, I'll back up to the November stuff. So we haven't even really talked about down ballot at the legislative level, which this is what has Texas House, especially Texas House Republicans, freaked out.
Yeah, there's been a lot of rumbling.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was already the case that Republicans were worried about losing seats. Some of those congressional seats we were talking about could go to the Democrats. The ones that were redrawn in South Texas are of particular concern to Republicans. But in the Texas House, I have heard that some of the GOP leadership is concerned about losing as many as 10 to 12 seats in the House, which would make it a completely different legislative chamber.
Talk about why it would, that is it would for people who don't follow the chamber.
Yeah,
like
so,
you
know, the Texas...
10 to 12 seats.
Yeah, why does that matter? Well, what that does is it would cut the Republican margin down to razor thin, like in Washington. And in the Texas House, the leadership is still elected on bipartisan basis. And so here you have the Speaker, Dustin Burroughs, who right now is probably sitting, you know, as if the numbers were to stay the same, probably be sitting pretty and wouldn't even be worried about whether he's going to be Speaker again. But it's my understanding that even when some of the newly elected, without saying who they were or who they are, some of the newly elected, very liberal, progressive Democrats were winning their primaries earlier this year, that he was already personally reaching out to them to ask, what do you need? You know, would you like
Burroughs
to sit down? Sit down and talk, because he's already thinking three steps ahead, trying to figure out where his support's going to be and trying to maintain the speakership. That's
smart,
right.
Move.
So we'll see what happens with that. And I would say, realistically, Democrats should pick up four or five seats without really even trying that hard, just because that's the national environment. If it gets really bad for Republicans, which all of this polling we're talking about indicates that it could, I could see the Democratic pickups being as high as about 10, if I'm being realistic. So that would change the dynamics in the House. The Senate shouldn't change much at all. In fact, you know, if it is bad for Republicans, as bad as we think, that newly elected freshman Democrat in Tarrant County could hold on to that seat. We'll all watch that really closely.
Yeah.
But you know, Senate will probably stay about the same. Then you have a clash between the governor and the lieutenant governor on property taxes. That's the big thing that's on a lot of folks' mind right now. Where here you have Patrick, who has been, I would give him some credit on this, a lot of credit. He's been a real student of the issue. And when I was working in radio in Houston many years ago, before he was a state senator, when he was a radio talk show host and then as a senator, he would show up at the Cy-Fair school board meetings and rail about people's property taxes, and the whole crowd would be cheering him on. He was doing that 20, 25 years ago.
This road show's been going for a while.
When he was on KSCB, he was doing that?
Oh, yeah. He would talk about it on his radio show all the time. He was railing about property taxes. He, more than anything else, more than immigration, abortion, gun rights, you name it, anti-LGBTQ stuff, any of that. The issue that he has ridden to power has been property taxes.
And he's had some success.
He's had some success, and he's reshaped what we do on that issue. Governor Abbott, it's as if he just learned it was an issue a few years ago. And so he comes out with some proposals that are just not serious.
He wants to abolish property
taxes. It's not a serious...
Right, exactly.
You know, I had a state senator say to me, one of my cigar-smoking buddies, a former state senator, say to me, right in the middle of the last legislative session, when, you know, once again, they're looking at a record budget surplus, as they did for a couple sessions in a row. And this former senator, a Republican, says, you know, now would be the time. We have all this extra money. Now would be the time to completely remake the way we do all this. Completely reimagine the system instead of the way we do the property taxes. Now locally, come up with something different, because when you have a bunch of extra money, that's when you can afford to make mistakes.
Yeah.
Is the easy way to think about it. But that didn't happen at all. Instead, what the governor did was just double down and triple down and quadruple down on what was done in 2019, which was to increase the rates of compression for people, which, without boring people with the details of that, the state buying down local property taxes, it costs a lot of money to do that. And the point that Patrick has made is, yeah, we can do some of that, but it's actually more cost effective and gets the relief to more people if we increase the homestead exemption. It's just cheaper for the state, and this is a difference that people have not really picked up on yet between what the governor's talking about and what Patrick is talking about. Patrick has pointed this out several times, and I'll amplify it for him right here. What the governor's talking about is more beneficial to extremely wealthy people. And what Patrick's talking about is more for middle-class people, right? And he gets that. He knows that that's better politics, and it's honestly better policy, and given the state of play that we have with the policy that we have. And so it's my understanding, without giving too many names away on this. And by the way, one note about on and off the record. So usually, if there's our rule at quorumreport.com has been since about 1986, before we were online, if there was alcohol present, it's off the record. And
okay.
My boss.
We'll cut all this out. Don't worry about it.
Well, my boss. Well, I'm making an exception for the show. We're just journalists here, so it doesn't count amongst us. But during COVID, and the reason that Harvey put that in place was because when he was first, getting involved with the players at the Capitol,
sure.
People didn't really understand what off the record meant.
Right.
Would he really not say whatever they had said? And so he established this rule: if it's present, then it's off the record.
Smart.
That would make people laugh, yeah. And they kind of like that. Anyway, during the COVID lockdowns, we kind of revised and extended the rule because people were just staying home drinking all the time, and alcohol has a half life, so everything at least started off the record. This is the kind of way we thought about it.
Ease back on.
I'm pressing record now.
but I never lose my place. So it's my understanding that Patrick has been trying to find some emissaries who will, on his behalf, go to Abbott and try to make the case that what you're trying to sell people is wrong, that this isn't going to work, because as far as I understand it, Abbott's not taking his phone calls about this. Mm. He does not want to talk to him about it because he knows what their differences are, and Abbott wants to get through his reelection campaign, at least. He wants to keep telling people that come next year, they're going to come up with a way to eliminate all of your property taxes when the Texas Senate leadership, which is staunchly conservative Republican, completely disagrees with that.
Interesting.
But it's not possible. What the governor wants to do, and he has not, Abbott has not explained how he would do this. He wants to abolish property taxes, but how do these cities and school districts continue to move on without the state income here. But one thing that Patrick has done, he's done a number of things over the years, and like you, I raise a glass to him for doing it because it saved all of us money. Now he wants to lower the homestead exempt, or the, what's it called, where you freeze property taxes?
Yeah,
right now they freeze
the property taxes at 65.
At 65. Let's lower it to
55. He says he wants to do it to 55.
Sure.
And somebody joked, they said that's the Gen X plan for for
hey,
property
hey,
taxes.
You know what? I'll take it. I'll take it 100%.
I think a lot of Democrats would get on board with that, honestly.
Yeah.
Patrick has tried to come up with some creative ways to offer some relief to people. I was talking, a different former state senator the other day said to me, you know, Scott, we have been fixing property taxes around here for about 50 years. The problem is nobody notices it. You know, everybody still pays a lot in it. The governor's offering something that's completely unrealistic, but it's just a bumper sticker right now. And I will say this too, it's an important piece of reporting. It's any time that I report on something anything that's a private conversation of Dan Patrick, where I have gotten some sources to say, here's what the lieutenant governor is saying in private meetings. Usually when I report that stuff, he will either call me the biggest liar in Texas media or take some other shot at me. But a couple of weeks ago, I reported that he started to tell senators that we need to be preparing in Texas for a possible deficit next session, that they might be in the red going into the next legislative session. He didn't say anything about that. He didn't say that I was wrong on that. So I do think that serious players at the Capitol are starting to consider what they might have to do if they don't have enough money.
Wow.
What the governor's talking about is using budget surpluses to buy down property taxes, surpluses that may not exist.
Right,
and I will say, for all of our Republican leadership, and it just happened, this is not a shot at Republicans, for all of our leadership in position now, Republicans, Democrats, most of them have never been at the Capitol for a budget cutting session. The last time we had that was in 2011.
Yeah.
And in the House and Senate, you know how many people are still in office who were in office at that time when the last time they had to really make
probably
cuts?
Not many, yeah.
30.
Very few.
30.
30?
Out of 180.
Between both chambers?
Yes. 181 members. Only 30 are still there who have any experience with a deficit budget.
The money has been flowing for a long time.
Wow. They don't know what it's like to be faced with budget cuts, things like Medicaid reimbursements and things like that, where you have a mom who's a Republican. There was some old video of this. A mom who's a Republican going through the Capitol with her son in a wheelchair. He has to blow in the tube to make it go, and she's handing out these cookies that are shaped like caskets with black icing, and they say, cuts kill. They haven't been through a session like that, and it could happen as soon as next year.
Scott, before we let you go, last thing. As we go into November, stakes are high. Mm-hmm. They've been high many times before, and you see the clean Republican sweep of that ticket
every time, over and over again.
Yeah. This time, the Lieutenant Governor, Senator Cruz, have both been warning Republicans, like, don't take this one for granted.
Right.
Are they just doing that to raise money and try to juice turnout, or is there a real threat this time? Do Democrats have any better chance this time than what we've seen in years past?
The two things can be true at once. They're always raising money. There was some reporting, I think, last week that the governor had told some donors in Houston behind closed doors that, oh, we're going to look at a blood, you know, we're going to see a bloodbath in Texas. Democrats are going to run the table, but they're not wrong to be sounding the alarm. And most of it is because of the national environment, and not so much to do with our candidates. Although we have some candidates who aren't going to help in appealing to the general election voter. Here's something that occurred to me as I was there with the Paxton folks last night at their party. Not only is the Republican slate this time around, not only was it decided in a Republican primary, which can be right-wing enough, a lot of this slate was decided in the Republican runoff.
Yeah.
When almost nobody votes. We were at, you know, 1.2 million or something like that, coming out of early vote last Friday. And so, you know, I tell people this all the time. I know I've said it to you guys, I'm sure. But the Republican primary in Texas and now the runoff, these are some of the most important elections on the planet that almost nobody votes in, because 500,000 to 750,000 people can set the leadership and the policy prescriptions for a state of 31 million Americans, right? And that doesn't change until more people either make some other decision in the general election or participate in the Republican primaries, which hasn't happened. And so I think that these candidates who are running on the Republican side, they're going to face a challenge that we haven't seen in the state in a long time.
You think so?
I do.
Wow.
I do. And I would say one other thing about it is, for all the money that will be spent, you know, on Paxton's behalf, a lot of that will come from, you already saw Governor Abbott attacking Tallarico, and the Lieutenant Governor has done some of that, and the other Republicans, those who have so much in the way of resources, they have to defend Paxton because their fate is tied to him, because he's the top of the ticket.
Yep.
And now he's mainstream Texas Republicans. You know, it's fascinating. Scott Braddock from the Quorum Report, man, it's always great to see you.
Cheers.
Call anytime. Appreciate it. Shout out to Petty Colas as well for having us, and we will see you next week.